This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Sridhar Devasagamy took apart motors, generators, and other equipment at a very young age because he wanted to understand how they worked. And he wondered, while riding on the back of his father's motorcycle in his native India, what would happen when there was no more gas to pump out of the ground to fuel it. That love of tinkering and interest in sustainability fueled the 2009 formation of Intellihot, a Galesburg maker of tankless water heating systems and other smart, clean technology devices. Intellihot has grown to more than 100 employees and counting, and in 2021 raised $50 million of growth funding and announced a significant expansion with a planned Chicago office. Sri, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Fantastic. Happy to be here, Kathleen. Thank you.
You got an undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering at Manipal Institute of Technology in India, but you educated yourself in and out of the classroom. Tell us about that.
Well, I think it goes back to my childhood days. I think my parents practiced an early form of what would be called free-range parenting, which I think they were, I'd like to think they were very advanced in what they did. So we had a lot of free time to pursue things that were of interest to us, doing what probably would now be called very dangerous, but things like, you know, breaking apart radios, breaking apart toys, figuring out how to make bonfire, figuring out how to melt iron. So it was a very interesting childhood that allowed me to explore different things all on my own.
Tell us about you tinkered with motorcycles. You had a motorcycle in college to make it more gas efficient.
Yeah, the whole thing started, you know, growing up. I was obviously very interested in motors, and you know, every toy I had. In fact, my parents often said, Sri, there is not a single working radio in the house. I mean, that was a thing I heard till I left for college. They actually bought a brand new set after I had left. And one of the things I learned very early on is you could take a DC motor, you know, from one of your toys, you supplied electricity, it ran. But if you spun it with your hand, it produced electricity. And being the 6-7-year-old kid that I was, I quickly said, I'm going to put two of these back to back, connect it, and I can make a perpetual machine and power the world. Why hasn't anybody thought about this? And so I tried to do it. I didn't understand about efficiency loss and, you know, you really can create perpetual machines and conservation of energy, any of that. And then when I would ride with my father, you know, on his motorcycle, we would talk about petroleum, you know, rock oil, literally comes from the ground. And I would ask my dad, hey, this stuff is going to run out one day. And what are we going to do? And every time we would go up a bridge and come down, I would tell my dad to shift into neutral so he's not wasting gas, you know. And so the thinking was very early on how to be energy efficient. And when I went to college, obviously I had a love for motorcycles. I had love for things that are intelligent. I had this very high performance bike, which gave me, I want to say, 12 to 15 miles per gallon. And the gas station, and I had a 5-gallon capacity. So I needed a gallon to get to the gas station, a gallon to come back, and I would have 3 gallons in reserve. So I was very, very motivated to make it go as long as it can. And it became a quest.
Sounds like you've had a lot of those kind of quests. After graduating, you started a company that developed one of India's first indigenously manufactured rock cutting burners and mined rock from quarries. But you soured on doing business in India. So you headed to the U.S. to Clemson University for a graduate degree in engineering. Then you landed in Peoria at Caterpillar. But you were always innovating on the side, even at Caterpillar, right?
Absolutely. You know, this quest for making things better, smarter, you know, as I reflect back on how it all started, in order for things to be better, they don't have to cost more or they don't have to, you know, be a huge lift. I'll give you an example. You know, one of the things I did in undergraduate was I couldn't really stand to have the incandescent bulb because I knew it consumed more power and I wanted to change it to something that was, you know, more energy efficient. And I built the circuit where you can take a blown fluorescent lamp, you know, it's got two filaments on each side. And one of them is blown, you throw them away, but you can take the blown fluorescent light, and with this high voltage circuit that I developed, you could make it work. And so my prized possession collection in undergraduate was a collection of blown blackened fluorescent lights that I carried around. It taught me two things. You can do more with less, and it does. It sometimes is actually free. So it, what seems a waste to somebody else is something useful. And I really built on that theme, starting back from my undergraduate days, and simply extended that theme into what I do today.
So you, when you were at Caterpillar, you started working on an autonomous motorcycle in your garage. You got diverted from that. You got diverted because you went on a trip and you came back home and you found that your water heater in your basement had broken and the basement flooded. That changed things, right? What did you think about that?
Yeah, you know, the universe has planned for you, right? And all the things that you do growing up brings you to a point, and you have this aha moment. I realized I tried a bunch of things. I was interested in energy efficiency, smart machines, motorcycles. And then when the water heater leaked in my house, at the time, me along with my friend, who's my partner now, Siva, we were building this smart semi-autonomous motorcycle. And when I saw how much water was in my house, and it was like having a bathtub of hot water 24/7, keeping it hot, and literally mostly what it did was heat the atmosphere, because it used less than 50% to really heat the water. It became again a quest to take the controls we had developed on the bike, and it was supposed to be a weekend project on making it better. And as we got into it, realized how big of a challenge it was. It was something that had not been done well for almost 100 plus years. And so that again became our life's mission to really, develop something that was better for the environment, better for us as human beings.
And the idea being that rather than having a water heater that's running all the time, heating water you're not using all the time, you were going to try and make it more efficient. So you start IntelliHot, you got it to the point, it now makes the first, second, and third largest tankless water heating systems in the world. You have more than 70 patents on your technologies. But let's talk about how it really works. Say I've got a 300-room hotel and a water heating system that's been in place for a while. Why would I want to switch to one of your systems?
Yeah, so the way we heat water is the same as we've been doing it since pretty much the Industrial Revolution. We put water in these gigantic, large containers, and we keep it hot 24/7, whether we're using water or not. The concept of heating water on demand, while it is not new, was never really attempted for very large buildings, because people simply believed you just couldn't do it. How am I going to power this 1,000-room hotel, or a large veterans hospital, or a large stadium? And when we came along, we figured out a way on how to heat large volumes of water on demand, and how to have consistent temperature, and how for it to be clean and safe and healthy water. Because when you have water in large containers, it's actually unhealthy, it grows bacteria. And so we showed we could do it. The other thing is, all of you probably have experienced this, you have to wait for water to get to your faucet. And if you end up adding all these small chunks of time, it ends up being 6 months of a human, the average lifespan of a person waiting to get hot water. We don't think much about it, but we are wasting good, clean, treated water that comes in, and we got to treat it again. So we wanted to address not only the efficiency problem, but really how water is heated and delivered.
So you addressed it, and now you've got all kinds of customers. You've got Marriott hotels and the San Francisco 49ers stadium. They're all using your systems, right? So what's interesting to me, you're embracing, I would say, the application of the Silicon Valley business model to the industrial space. Tell us about how you're doing that.
I landed at an interesting point with all, me and my co-founder, with all the different experiences. We started to think about this in an entirely different manner. First off, we started by saying, let's heat water on demand, which means we shouldn't store it. which means we can provide good, clean, healthy water. We thought about it as a modular system. Today, when you go into a hotel or a hospital, they would put in one system to handle the load, and then they would put a duplicate system because they're so worried that the first system would break down on a Friday night. They actually double. So you now have two systems running 24/7 and keeping, you know, thousands of gallons of water hot. And that doesn't seem like a very efficient way of doing things. So we basically blew up that model and we decided to do something very different. Heat on demand, modularize the system, bring in IoT and connectivity so it can predict what's going to happen and provide water, obviously, with no bacteria in it.
Big dashboard telling you everything that's going on all over the place, right?
You know, yes, it's always very easy to say when things are broken. What is hard to say is how things are going to be. And we call that prognostics. And we do quite a good job of, depending on how customers use a product and how they utilize it, making predictions on they need to do this or they need to do that way ahead in time. So they're not surprised.
You're a disruptor in an entrenched industry. What's the biggest challenge you've had building your company?
You know, the biggest challenge I would say is a lot of, nobody has done it in 100 years, you're like a Tesla. You're coming here saying the car doesn't need a gas engine. And you're also saying maybe we don't need dealerships to sell it. You're basically upsetting the apple cart. So people for generations are used to doing things in one way. They don't have a choice or they don't know about a different way. And so we get questioned a lot about, will this actually work? Will you guys be around? Can I really put faith in powering a large building? And we have now shown time and again that we are a better, safer, reliable way of doing things. And I really hope not just Intel, I hope the entire industry really transforms to this, because we got to really make a dent on what's going on with CO2. And this is a terrific way of, you know, making sure the business get a good return. They are reliable, they're safe. And at the same time, we are actually doing good for the planet.
You recently raised $50 million. How has that impacted your company's growth?
This is a very important raise for the company. I think we are at a point where the company has shown, world-class blue-chip customers who have adopted our product. And it's a question of really scaling up. And so we are devoting a substantial amount of money to scale the company. And the one thing that you might be interested to know is, internally, we don't think of ourselves as a water heating company. We think of a company that is involved along with a few other people in this quest to solve the energy crisis and the global warming crisis. And so I fully expect IntelliHot to be launching other products that are going to solve a few other pieces of this energy puzzle, all in the built environment. So this funding will go a long way. We have formed an innovation team, again, made up of people who have no background in this industry. So we're going to pull in guys from, you know, robotics, HVAC, diesel engines, and put them all together to come up with something entirely different.
Thanks so much for spending time with us, Sri, and good luck going forward.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine. I appreciate it.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Zach Homestead was a sophomore in college when the blimpy sub shop he worked at closed, forcing him to find another job. The IT department at his school, University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, provided that next job, and a whole lot more. Zach managed the then small number of Apple computers on campus and saw firsthand how many tools there were for Microsoft compared to Apple. So in 2002, while still in school, Zach started Jamf, a software company whose products help IT professionals manage Apple devices in corporate environments. The more Apple grew, the more Jamf grew. Now headquartered in Minneapolis, Jamf has more than 2,300 employees. more than 60,000 customers, and its products run on more than 26 million devices around the world. The company went public in July 2020 and raised $468 million. Zach, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me today.
You moved up and eventually had responsibility for all the Macs on UW-Eau Claire's campus while you were still a student. Tell us about how many there were and what that job was like.
Yeah, so altogether, there were about 400 Macs on campus. There were 200 that were faculty computers, and then about 200 spread across the labs on campus. So my job was much more focused on the faculty side. So my job really entailed anytime a faculty member had an issue with their computer, whether it was with a piece of software or trying to print or anything else like that, or they were getting a new computer and needed an upgrade of any sort. I was one of the people that would walk to their office and help out however I could. On the lab side, I started to get involved in that a couple years into my role there, which really helped me understand, you know, another level of what that world looks like. That's not just individual users at a computer like a faculty member, but this is a computer that's got to be set up for a new student every hour when they walk in and start the class.
Not a bad gig for a music major, but it must have been a lot of on-the-job training, right?
It was a lot of on-the-job training. It was really a fantastic place to be for that. I had my first boss there was a guy named Matt Unger. I just learned an absolute ton from him, both on the technical side and on the human side of IT. And then when I moved up and started full-time, my boss, Chip Eckert, was another guy that was just super helpful in my development, both on the technical side and on the human side of IT.
It's funny to think about. You came in thinking you were going to be a piano player, and you left with a company. when did you come up with the idea for starting Jamf?
So we were founded in 2002, and it, you know, would have been a pretty quick ideation to founding. And we shipped, you know, at the end of 2002, we shipped our 1.0 version. So everything happened really quickly. It wasn't a super long time of thinking about it. Once I decided that, hey, I think this could be something outside of my job here. I could take the skill set that I've learned and start applying it in a larger way. That all happened really, really quickly.
And you wrote a lot of the code, right, for that initial product?
I did. I wrote a lot of code for about 10 years.
How'd you learn how to do that?
So while I was a music major, I was a computer science minor. So I had just enough knowledge to be dangerous. And I mean that quite literally. I was not the world's best programmer by any means, but definitely had enough skill set to build product and solve problems. And at the end of the day, that's what we needed back then.
In the early days, Apple computers were it was artists, musicians, graphic designers. It wasn't companies who were using Apple products. What made you stick with Apple and not branch out to other brands like Microsoft?
That's a really good question. So for us, what Apple represented was, the most human side of technology. They were there to try and put technology out in a way that allowed you to create whatever you were trying to create. So their goal was to get the technology out of the way of the person doing something. And I was really drawn to that. You know, as a musician, that was the platform that I learned a lot of things on. And I saw a lot of other creative type people, as, you know, the list that you just gave are all creative people, right? So they're drawn to the platform because it gets the technology out of the way and helps them create. And so we were just really drawn to that vision, really believed that, you know, while they had a tiny market share in the world at that point, that it was still helping people in a way that was disproportionate to that market share. So we were just really tied to that platform. We loved the ability to create and give great experiences to people that were using it.
You connected with Chip Pearson, who was running an IT consulting firm in Minneapolis, and soon the two of you were co-leading the company. You spent a lot of time selling that initial product called Casper Suite. Now it's been renamed to Jamf Pro. Tell us about how you went about, the two of you went about selling it in the early days.
Yeah, that was kind of a full-time job for both of us. I mean, in a startup like that, you have lots of full-time jobs. And so it was a lot of trial and error, I think, on figuring out what the best way that we connected with our customers was. And so what we really learned is that back then in, you know, 2004, 2005, we didn't connect remotely well. So we would do demos over WebEx, and we had a very low close rate, but we found out that if we were in front of people, we had a much, much higher close rate. So basically I'd say that the majority of the revenue that we made in those first 5 years went into travel so that we could go be in front of people, have that human connection, get to answer their questions in person. So it was a lot of time on airplanes, a lot of time in hotel rooms, going to meet with people in person, was how we were successful in those early years.
Was that mostly in the US or was that outside the country as well?
It was mostly in the US, but our first trip to London was, would have been in May of 2004. So we were starting to expand over there. We had customers in Europe pretty much from day one, but we didn't really start trying to focus on it until kind of that 2004 timeframe. And from that point forward, I would be over in London or other parts of Europe at least two or three times a year, every year.
Early on, you didn't have many competitors and people weren't thinking of Apple as a corporate option. But when Apple introduced the iPhone in 2007, everything changed. How?
Yeah. So obviously the iPhone was a huge hit for Apple. And fast forward a couple of years to about 2010, they released the ability for companies like us to manage the iPhone. So the iPhone and the iPad, which was just released, I think in 2009, were suddenly devices that people were trying to bring into the office and they wanted management like we did on the Mac side. And so overnight we went from, you know, two real competitors and four competitors all together in the market, to about 100 competitors. The space just blew up. There was just incredible amounts of investment happening in the space. So our world really got flipped, and we went from this tiny market that was very niche that we knew everyone in, we knew all the competitors, to this huge unknown group. Everyone who was significantly better funded than we were. So it was a big shock to our world. But the difference was for us, we had a well-established business on the Mac side of the world. And all of these companies that were getting spun up to manage the mobile side, were managing iOS and maybe Android. So while we were adding iOS to what we did, we had the Mac side that was already pretty established business for us and continuing to grow. And so our thesis was that if we continued to grow the Mac side of our business and grew the iOS side the best that we could, that if you fast forward 5 years down the road, that 100 competitors would have died down to about five. And when we got to 2015, that's about where the market was.
Had you even raised money before then? Had you bootstrapped?
We had raised money. So I think I have a hard time with some of the dates, but we had definitely raised at least one very small round. And that was probably around the time that we did our first real raise with Summit Partners. So we had them on board. We would have definitely had great guidance coming from them as we were trying to figure out how to weather that storm of, again, four competitors to 100 overnight is a big shock.
Well, you must have had to really ramp up your staffing too, right?
We didn't ramp up the way that the competitors that showed up in the market did. We were still continuing to try and grow very responsibly. So if you looked, we were kind of year over year growing our staff 20 to 30%, which was the same way we were basically growing our revenue. So we were just really solid 30% year over year growth, for a very, very long time. It probably, changed how we resourced some of the growth. But we definitely didn't go out and raise money the way that a lot of those competitors did, to try and just blow up a staff, blow up a marketing team. Move forward. We stayed very, very consistent with the plan that we already had laid out.
In 2017, you guys sold a majority stake in the company to Vista Equity Partners, a private equity firm. What made you decide to do that at that point? You'd resisted. You'd had what, 125 offers before then?
Gosh, I don't think we had that many, but we definitely had offers before then. And Vista represented something that was new to us. So for us, it was always coming back to figure out, all right, what does this mean for our customers? What does this mean for our employees? What does this mean for the shareholders, and what does it mean for the brand? And unless we were happy about all four of those outcomes, you know, we turned down a lot of things. So when Vista came along, we were very confident that the organization would continue down the same path it was on, that the customers would be at least in the same spot they were, or a better spot. The employees would be in the same spot they were, or a better spot. And the brand got to stay intact. You know, for us, it was really kind of doing the gut check on all of those things. Is, are we going to look back in 5 years and have regret on what happened to any of those groups? And we're at 4.5 years now. Customers are still growing a lot. Employees are growing a lot. You know, all of the fears from the outside about they're going to close certain offices down or they're going to lay people off have not happened at all. Instead, you just continue to see investment and growth in the organization.
After you guys sold the company to Vista Equity Partners, you left and you started doing things more locally in Eau Claire. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I actually left at the Vista acquisition. And since then, I've been focused on another organization that we started called Pablo Group. Pablo Group has been focused solely on revitalizing downtown Eau Claire. So that means we've invested in a couple hotels, a bunch of restaurants, a bunch of coffee shops, a couple bars. We've got a co-working space that's downtown Eau Claire. And we've also got a couple apartment buildings that we've renovated and opened up. So it's really been about, this is my hometown. I remember when I was 5 or 10 years old going downtown and seeing a lot of activity. And then when I was in middle school and high school, as you saw across the US in the 80s, you know, downtown just died out. And part of this even goes back to, you know, when we opened the first Eau Claire Jamf office, downtown Eau Claire was still a bit of a ghost town. And we opened our office up down there proudly with four employees in downtown Eau Claire because we wanted to be part of what we thought was going to happen in downtown Eau Claire. And so, you know, today we've got, I think, about 300 employees working downtown. We've got just a lot of activity that you didn't see 7 or 8 years ago. There's just a lot of really good stuff happening downtown. And it's not just us doing it. There's a lot of investment from the university, the city, other businesses that are down there. It's just really cool to see the growth happening down there.
Love the way you're trying to turn your business success into local success for the community. Thanks so much for taking the time and sharing your story. And good luck with Eau Claire.
Hey, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Ellie Ellis. Join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear from more visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies. That's right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.